session number 23447, rail 7.
Mr. Waller, Rio 7. We're talking about the time of the Battle of Knightsbridge,
yeah.
In very end of May, early June 1942. Mm. And you'd been issued with a new six-pounders. What was your job in the team?
I was a loader at that time.
Was that any different from what it had been with the two-pounder, other than the bigger shell?
No. No, just, you know... It was, you couldn't carry so much ammunition with you, because they were bigger. And you had so many boxes, and you just pulled the handle, opened the breech, loaded one, tapped your number three on the shoulder to let him know it was loaded, because with all the noise going on, he couldn't necessarily hear it go up. And then he would fire either if he had a target himself, or your corporal, Alf Reeves, would be standing behind you with the binoculars.
Bill Ash was there
at the time, yeah.
And what do you remember of the actual fighting during that period?
Very confused. It was... We were dashing here and there. When tanks broke through, you went, or whatever, you went through and you dropped your gun down. Didn't dig it in, of course, you hadn't got time. You just dropped it on the, ran it off the pool tee, dropped it down, fire so many shots, you know, and get some in return. And then if either the opposition gave way, or if you had to go away, you pulled back, or somebody gave the order, right, away somewhere else, it'll break through somewhere else, and you'd be running here and there fighting.
And what about the comparison of the effects on tanks of two-pounder and six-pounder shells?
Oh, I mean, a six-pounder, you definitely had a chance, as long as you could hit them in the side or the back. Not too much if you hit them on the front, but a two-pounder was would knock out an Italian M13, but it wouldn't touch a Mark III or Mark IV.
That's what you were dealing with?
Yeah.
Mark IIIs and IVs.
Mark III and IVs, yeah. And you could knock them out, all right, with a six-pounder, but a two-pounder was hopeless.
So where would they aim? What was the best aiming point? You say the side or the back?
Well, yes, you, preferably. If you could get them side on, or even partially side on, you're not likely to get one at the back unless it swung round, but you aimed it side on. Because the front had a reinforced plate in front of it, and or the only other thing is, if you couldn't get a side on, you aim for the turret below the gun, because there's a chance that if you hit it, it would dip down and it was not so thick there, or at least it would cause flakes of metal to fly off the inside of the tank and at least put the gunner out of action.
And how long did this confused period last for you, or any particular instance within it?
No, it was all the way back. We were more or less fighting a rear guard. We would be dropped off. The whole army was moving back, and we'd be dropped off. And as the German tanks were coming up, we would sit there, fire, depending on the strength of the opposition. We might fire half a dozen rounds, we might fire 12 rounds, and then we'd hook up and move away again, you know, and giving the main army a chance to pull out of it, you know, all the soft-skin vehicles. But all the time you were just moving, stopping, almost like forming a roadblock. And you'd stop them and then...
Did you ever come under much fire yourself? I mean, I
oh, yeah, I mean, well, obviously, if there's enemy tanks or armoured cars. The armoured cars sometimes would catch up quicker because they were faster. But they would come up and their guns were smaller than the six-pounder. They were about 37 millimetre. But they used those and the machine guns and would But you, what you tried to do was get in your shot first while they were still a little bit out of range or out of effective range. And, you know, you were exchanging fire all the time, but we were extremely lucky. We didn't... well, up to a point, we got one. I mean, what had happened, I told you, with firing the gun... because sometimes I took over from Bill, you know, if he'd been firing a lot, you know, we'd do it, because you were trained to do both. And
so you'd take over as layer?
Yeah, he'd take over as layer and I'd take over as fire, you see. It was, so you could both keep your hand in.
And he'd take over as loader, you mean?
He would take over as loader, yeah, and I'd take over as layer. Because, obviously, you know, to keep squinting with one eye down the telescopic sight... After a while, with the heat haze and the dust and everything else, you know, you could do with giving your eye a rest, so we used to change over. But I'd say we were lucky that, in as much that I thought something had happened, he fired the gun, and it, you know, because what happened, we got to one stop, we were firing away at some armoured cars, and... there must have been a tank there as well because of the shell, the size of the shell, I found out afterward. And I, you know, I got the bang and I, bloody hell, but I thought that he fired the gun before I got out of the way, you see. And it was then he said, well, silly so-and-so, you've been hit. What had happened, it must have been a shell exploded nearby and it took my eye and the top of my nose open and... But I was the only one, so...
The others were unhurt?
No, the others weren't, no. It must have landed on my side, you see. They were... Alf Reed must have been over to the left and Bill was on the side and I was loading and I was... must have been on the side the shell landed, you see.
How bad were the cuts?
Well, I mean, what happened, it split it right across and it flapped down and... hit the top of my nose as well, but I couldn't see out of that eye. So what he did was he got it back and he got a couple of safety pins and shoved it through. And
who did?
Bill Ashley pinned this back, you see, and then slapped the field dressing on because you didn't have any, you know, bandage or sticky plaster or anything like that. And you know, I'm sure if he had a big sticking plaster, you know, he could have squeezed it together and banged it over and it would have held it, but, you know, and there was no time to do any stitching or anything. Not that we had any needle or stitching, but he used a couple of safety pins and put this field dressing round.
Did it hurt or was it numb?
Well, you know, thick head, you know, as if somebody was hitting me inside with a hammer, you know, going bang, 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 bang. And, so I didn't really feel anything. It was... after the impact, you know, I didn't feel anything when he shoved the pin through.
Did you carry on the gun? You know?
Yeah, I was loading. I carried on loading, you know, and I was still doing that because there was nowhere to go. I mean, we were still running and still being used as
what happened to the tank and the armoured cars?
We hit it, you know, got the armoured car, but not the tank, you know. Well, not as far as we know. I mean, if we hit it, it didn't stop it, so...
But you didn't see it again? It didn't.
No.
What happened when you hit an armoured car? I mean, what effect would the shell have on it? Would it be more dramatic than with a tank? Or?
Well, yes, because it would like to go right through it, and chances are it might set it on fire. So it would go right through it. Where a tank, it's as they show you in the training field, a tank, when it gets hit by an armour-piercing, the armour-piercing shot, it's almost white hot, the speed it travels. So when it hits the side of the tank, that's white hot. And it bursts through there, but it hasn't got enough impetus to burst out the other side. So it gets through and whirls round and round and obviously chops up the crew inside, you see, or bits fly off from the inside of the tank, you know. We used to be shown that on a training film and it was rather vivid.
And so would the tanks brew up or were they not likely to brew up?
Sometimes they did, but not not like ours, the British tanks were all ran on high octane. So if you got one anything within 2 yards...
Did you ever see a British tank brew up?
Oh, God, yes.
Can you describe what it looked like?
Well, just sort of loud explosion and sort of flames and black smoke come out. And very rarely did the crew come out unless they were very quick. If anybody got out, it was the tank commander who was sitting up in the turret. Might get the gunner, but anybody, the down below, the driver and the machine gunner, wireless operator, there ain't got much chance, you know, because they just used to explode.
So what's next? So you've been wounded, but you're still on your gun.
Oh yeah,
with your thing.
With a big pad over my eye, you know, and that you've got on a field dressing, you know, bandage with a big pad that soaks it all up.
So what happened next? What's the next thing you remember of this period?
Well, we were keeping on moving and acting as this rear guard, and it was a normal procedure, as it were, except only one good eye to look out of. And this was really carried on. We thought we were... I don't know whether it was a bush telegraph or what, but everybody thought we were going to stop at Mirza Matru, because some months previously we'd gone through there and they were digging into the rock and burying supplies, food and ammunition and everything else. So everybody thought that was where we were going to stop.
You'd gone past Tobruk then?
Yes, we were flapping back at a hell of a rate. I mean, the speed at which the retreat, if you can call it that, or the retirement, depending how you like to look at it, was really moving. I mean, it was moving day and night. We went to Tobruk. In fact, we lost one of our portees on mines there. You know, there was mines had been laid and nobody quite knew where they were. And
not your portee, another
one. No, not here, one of the others in within the company.
So what happened as you got near Mirza?
Well, we just carried on and it was the same old thing. We just couldn't understand why we weren't stopping at Mirza. Everybody thought that's where the dumps were and what we were going to do. And in fact, the one dump we went past, we all had time for a breather, and we stopped, and I said to one of our chaps, nip over, see if you can get anything out there, out the dump. And the red cap stopped him and said, oh, you can't come in here, we're going to blow it up. He said, well, why can't I take something? But they wouldn't let us, they just bloody blew the lot up. And that's what was happening, they were blowing up the dumps of food, petrol, on the way back, and it was just, as you went down, I mean, although we were in the rear, you know, there were people on the way saying, move, 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 and keeping everybody moving, you know, it was a complete rout almost, you know, that's not described that in the annuals of the British Army, but it was, we were just flapping back and... until we got to Alamein.
So what happened there?
Well, we were in part of the line there, more down towards the south.
Did anything happen when you got to Alamein? I mean, did you realise you'd stopped there?
Oh, yes, because that was when they said, right, start digging in position. And part of it was that, surprisingly enough, was rocky rather than a soft sand, and the engineers were using pneumatic drills to dig gun pits and so forth. So it was obvious to anybody then that that's where we were going to make this stand and hold this line.
And what were your positions like there? Did you have help to dig in or...?
No, we were on softer soil, so we were able to dig our own.
And this would be late June?
Yep.
42?
Yeah.
And you'd stay there until October?
Well, what happened was then, it would have been end of June, July, the 9th Battalion were pulled out the line and we were sent down to Mena because we needed about 50% replacements. And we were sent down to Mena and they carried on doing training for a short while.
So very similar to what had happened the previous.
The 6-pounders we were loading, and we mishap because we were loading and we used the pyramids, aim on the top of the pyramid. Well, what you did was, in order to give both people a chance, you took the firing mechanism out so that the number two could push the shell in there and it would knock the two feeders back and the breech would come up. But because when the number three couldn't pull the lever back to fire, so you did so long like that to give the number two chance. Then you put the firing mech back in, but instead of putting the shell up the spout, you reversed it and hit the two feeders with the base end of the thing, and the breech would come up, and then of course he could lay on fire because it was so that he didn't jerk it, he pulled it and he didn't swing off. It was all right until somebody said, right, one more time, then we break nappy break, and forgot the firing mech was in, shoved the shell up and fired, and a bit of the pyramid went ding. Well, we've been worried since when I've been back in case I get presented with a bill.
Did it do much damage?
Well, I don't know. It, solid shot, fortunately, so it just knocked a bit of the brickwork out.
Do you know which pyramid it was?
No, it was one of them at Mena. So
you were rebuilding the battalion again for the second time?
Yeah, but then they came around and I don't know whether they didn't have enough reinforcements in the country or what, but they said, sorry, but there's not enough reinforcements, so one battalion has got to go. Because we had, you see, there was the 1st and 2nd battalions, which were both the regular battalions. I think it was the 7th that came out by then, and there was a 9th territorial battalion. And they said, well, one of you got to go. So they said, we're going to disband the 9th Battalion, which is the one I was in. And they sent a Carter back to England, and to Retford, and they called that the 9th Battalion, and it was a home battalion. And those of us that were there, the 50% of us were left, were then sent off to reinforcements to the 1st and 2nd Battalion.
And that would be when? July?
July.
So how did you feel about that? I mean, what was your reaction to it?
A bit shattered, really, you've been with the battalion, you knew people, and you thought, God, what are we going to...
Did you stay with your two chums, your special
pals? Oh, yeah, we went... That was a good thing. They kept us at a gun team. We were sent to the 1st Battalion.
Now, where were the 1st Battalion at the time?
Down at Allen... Down the south end of the line at Alam Halfa, yeah.
And what were your first impressions when you joined the 1st Battalion? They were regulars. How did it differ from the 9th?
Well, when you said they weren't regulars, really, because the old regulars all got lost at Calais. So the reformed one were the same as us, really, except they weren't territorials and the 9th Battalion were.
So you didn't notice much difference, really?
No. In any case, you didn't mix with anybody. We went up and we were put in position. We never saw anybody else. You didn't see the rest of the battalion. You only saw two guns, your gun and another one, and you knew about 12 people, and you knew your own platoon and your own officer, but that was it. You never saw the rest of the battalion while you were there. When you were in defensive positions, you were just one or two guns, and that was it.
So to you, it didn't make any difference, really?
No, it made no difference to us, you know, but... You know, in some respects, we felt it was, sad that the battalion had been broken up, you know. It had been out there about 2 years. And I suppose in another way, we felt, well, we've got the 1st Battalion now, yeah. What's this promotion? Because the 1st Battalion, had a reputation, apart from peacetime, it had been lost at Calais and then reformed and... You know, they suffered much the same fate as we had. So,
now, what do you remember of the what were your defensive positions like? You around Alan Helfer?
Well, just standard position. Well, what we were doing, we were going up. There was a high, can't call it a mountain, but a high ridge called Hamimet Ridge. And we used to we'd go up there, say, for a spell of three or four days. You'd get shelled all the bloody time. And you were just watching, really, from the high ground. And we never fired. We were just up there, and we used to get shelled. And then after three or four days, you get relieved, and you come back.
What was it like in the shell fire? I mean, how did you cope with it?
Jump into a slit trench and become an instant Christian. you got so used to it, really. You felt safe in it. It's amazing. A slit trench, as long as it was 3 foot or 4 foot deep, you were okay, unless they used air bursts and you got one more or less over your slit trench, then you were in trouble.
And that obviously didn't happen.
No, quite.
I should have asked, how was your wound? Did you have to actually go out?
No, when I got back, I went along the regimental aid post, and they cleaned it up and just
put the flap of skin back.
Yeah, put it back and stitched it and dressed it properly and said, it's okay, you know.
So you didn't actually have to leave the unit?
No, I didn't leave the unit, no.
So you'd go up on the Hamimet,
yep.
Sorry, I can't pronounce that too well. And what else would happen during this period? Because there's sort of this 4 or 5 months of waiting.
That's right. All you were doing was, I say, on the high ground observing, you know. Sometimes they'd send out armoured patrols, but it was mainly long-range shelling that you had to suffer, you know. And they knew you were on the top, so they used to, you know, get a regular stonking from their artillery, and you get down in the slit trench and crouch down there and say your prayers, and it stopped. You know, it might go on for half an hour, might go on for an hour and a half, depending how nasty they were feeling.
And what happened next then?
Well, then they must have got word that the Germans were going to make this attack.
This is when the Germans came round.
At Alan Helfer, they were trying to get round because they could only come through us because the sea of sand was the other side. No vehicles could get through. And of course, at the other end, the northern line, you had the sea. So that, he thought, was his best bet, his final push to get through to Cairo.
And what do you remember of that attack?
Well, that one, they put the tanks behind us in hull down positions, and they stuck us four guns out in the front. There were two of us in the front, and two, the other two were slightly on our flanks and further behind us, and the put us out there, and they said, mark out something 300 yards away. Well, we put an empty petrol tin there, and they said, that's your maximum range. because the tanks were all behind us, you see. So they said, don't open fire over 300 yards. So we measured out 300 yards.
Why not? I mean...
Well, so that, you see, our tanks couldn't do any damage within a Liberty range, you see. I mean, our tanks were not as heavy armoured and didn't have such big heavy guns as they did. So, I mean, a lot of them were still... Some of the honey tanks, or the cruisers, had 37 millimetres. And it was... really, they were outranged. That was the trouble. So they didn't want where they were in the hold-down positions, they didn't want to be at extreme range because they weren't going to inflict any damage. So they said to us, well, your maximum range is 300 yards.
So they didn't want you to open fire until...
Until they were in the within the range of the tanks, you see. And obviously the two at the side would be slightly further for them because they were further back. And we got a story, and it wasn't until years later that I ever read about this and believed it, but and also saw it on a film or something, that the idea was that they were going to send out an armoured car on reconnaissance, which was then going to get deliberately captured or hit, as it was, it got hit. And they left some plans in for gaps in the minefield, so it all sounds a bit boy's own far-fetched, but apparently it was quite true.
And you heard this at the time?
Yeah, we heard this at the time, that's what they're going to do. And we were told about this, because they said, oh, what they do, we'll leave these plans and they'll come through so that they come straight onto your guns. And that's why, you know, it'd be dead easy for you, it'd be a shoot-up. And so he said, right, likely story, you see. So we were dug in these positions, about 3 foot deep, at Allen Halfer, and we saw an armoured car come with him back. Tanks are coming. And we sit there and wait, and goes on and all. And then the first tank, you could see them then, about 70 of them, I think. First tank started moving forward, and the first commander's tank came up and very obligingly almost stopped on top of this petrol tin we put out. I said to Bill, that one's ours. And nothing had been fired then. So we fired. He was a goner because he was side on, so we hit him straight away then. And once we fired, of course other tanks started firing up, because one gun came up and two of the crew bailed out of this one to get on the back of this other tank. We fired at it. On the front it just bounced off, so we fired at the turret and the track, but it still kept going, and it started backing away, and then the machine guns opened up on us, which penetrated. There's two shields, you've got a main curved shield and a small one in the front, and they must have been loaded with that armour piercing, because they went through the front shield and deflected off the curved shield behind, also went through, knocked the sights out of our gun and tore the... But nobody was hit. If it hadn't been for the shield, we'd have all been goners, but